So am I still waiting? Waiting a long time.
Waiting for tonight. Oh.
Listen to Review Way.
Waiting. It's John Pollock here for another riveting edition of Review Away. Today, Way, we are reviewing The King of the Ring 1998, which will always be remembered as the show where Ken Shamrock became the King of the Ring.
Are you sure? Are you sure about that?
There might have been another match on here that stands the test of time, but it's an exciting edition of Review Away. Jim Ross will be joining us on today's program, Way, to recall...
He's right here.
He is. JR. He's having some barbecue sauce and a coffee in our studio here.
Hey, Jim.
Hey.
He'll be stepping in, taking over this chair in just a bit.
In just a few minutes, as we... it's almost going to be like this interview took place in November of 2000 with Jeff Merrick.
Huh.
That's what it's going to sound like. But perhaps the most famous match that JR has ever called, I would say, because I think most fans associate this Hell in a Cell match the most when they think of Jim Ross. But we're going to get into that later. Lots of stuff to get to on this show, including your feedback and what is coming up next week. But we'll start off with our recap, Way. June the 28th, 1998, from the Igloo in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. It was the King of the Ring, 1998, and we open up the show, Way, with a video. Kane promising to light himself on fire if he doesn't win the WWF Championship tonight from Steve Austin, with Undertaker and Mankind also featured in the opening video promoting their Hell in a Cell match for later tonight in the double main event.
Mm-hmm.
What did you think of this stipulation when you first heard
that,
it, Way?
That he would light himself on fire?
Yes.
I thought we were going to see it. I was really hoping to see a main... I was hoping to see something like that Sting incident that we saw at the Great American Bash 2000.
This was a far cry from the Great American Bash of 2000. We then start the event. Jim Ross and Jerry Lawler are on commentary. And to put everyone into context of where this event fits, this, I would say, was at the height of the Monday Night Wars. In the spring of 98, if you remember at this point, this was probably... It was a week before Bill Goldberg won the WCW title from Hulk Hogan. Both companies were still doing very, very solid pay-per-view numbers, doing very solid television numbers. The WWF had ended the 83-week win streak the past April, so both companies very healthy at this point in time in mid-1998.
Mm-hmm.
So we go into our first match, Way, which is announced as... a bonus match. One of two bonus matches, meaning we mistimed this show and needed some filler. So that led to a six-man tag to kick things off. Way, we have Taka Michinoku and the Headbangers taking on Kai and Tai, consisting of Sho Funaki, Men's Tao, and Dick Togo.
That's right. I was a huge, huge fan of Kai and Tai. Not from their WWF run, but from their Michinoku Pro run, when they're all together with... Kaz Hayashi, some of the best six-man and eight-man tag team matches that I've ever seen.
They put together some of the best tag matches of that time period. Mm-hmm. So if you're only going by their WWF run as a comedy group, and really, Togo and Tao were there for about a cup of coffee as we sip our coffee sound lively. They weren't even in there long. And if probably the best North American outlet to see some of them perform is the first ECW pay-per-view, Barely Legal, mm-hmm. where they have a six-man on that show.
Mm-hmm.
So this, of course, features Taka wearing the Headbanger shirt and a, what do they call it, a skirt? Or is it a, or was he wearing a kilt?
Yeah, weren't they kilt?
Okay.
Well, they had shirts that say real men wear skirts.
Yeah. So Taka got a pop because of his decision to drop Japanese culture and become American. The Melting Pot is actually what the three of them were called.
It was really awkward seeing Taka try to headbang.
Did you find it somewhat odd that you had the Headbangers with Taka wearing a Headbanger shirt, and on the opposing team you had Dick Togo come down wearing an Iron Maiden shirt?
I did find that weird. I was wondering if he had just... I didn't know if it was a subtle you know, message.
I don't know if it was a subtle message, more just a lack of quality control of trying to differentiate the two teams. Did you ever notice, and this really got hit on over the head by myself during this match, was that WWF commentators, they never say Japan. It's always the land of the rising sun.
I didn't notice that. Maybe they weren't sure where they were from.
As we continue to play dress-up critiques here, Funaki was wearing his pay-per-view best outfit of a zip-up hoodie for this match. And then we get into the actual match.
It's just so weird to think that Funaki, out of all of them, was the one to stick behind for 10 years.
Funaki lasted... This was 98. He only got released this year. 12 years he lasted in the company. It's amazing when you think about it. Funaki and Mark Henry.
Yeah. Yeah, look at... Let's run down the card. How many of the people are still on the roster?
There's Kane, Undertaker, Funaki and Mark Henry. Well, Funaki's gone. Is that about it? We'll keep tabs as we go through the matches. Jeez. But early on, there was a springboard plancha by Taka to the floor. Then a cool spot where Togo delivered he went for a baseball slide and then turned it into a head scissors onto Taka onto the floor. Then a very weird spot as Togo goes off the ropes and attempted what looked like a uranage onto Taka, which Taka ends up... It was Taka who hits the uranage, and he is the one that sells the move while Togo gets up right away after taking the move. Didn't make sense. Taka then sold throughout the match, built to a hot tag with both headbangers coming into the ring. The headbangers lifted Taka and drop him into a splash-like maneuver onto Funaki, and then Taka hits the Michinoku driver for the win. I thought this was a pretty decent opening match, yeah. And Kai and Tai, they were never really utilized for their in-ring skills. They really became a comedy act and didn't get to really showcase much, and this was maybe one of their more standout matches, even though they were given probably 6 minutes in this opener.
Yeah, it was a bonus match, so who cares?
Yes, it was just gravy. Jim Ross then asks Jerry Lawler about a match coming up later between Al Snow and Head versus Too Much, and Lawler says that Too Much, they cannot depend on Lawler for this win tonight. Then Sable comes out, which I guess was necessary because Sable was on the front of this, on the poster for this event, and this was her only involvement on the show. She came out to the ring in a one-piece leather outfit that I doubt many would probably wear in public. She milks the pop so that the crowd eventually starts chanting her name. Then Sable introduces Vince McMahon, who gets great heat coming to the ring with Briscoe and Patterson, and I liked it at this point where Vince didn't have theme music, and he was just part of the office.
I like that, too. And they weren't he wasn't the only one without theme music. I mean, come to think of it, you know, like, for some of these things, like the invasion angles, you shouldn't have theme music with the guy.
You shouldn't have any production value attached to
it. It should just be a guy walking out.
Promotion. This led to Chance of Austin. Patterson and Briscoe politely ask Sable to leave, and on her way out, Patterson touches Sable's ass and gets slapped in the face, which was very amusing that they booked Pat Patterson for that spot.
They could have probably only used Pat Patterson for that.
Well, Sable would have sued them then for sexual harassment if it had been...
not Pat Patterson.
No. Then Briscoe checked on the face of Pat Patterson to make sure he was okay. And then,
did you catch JR saying something like, Patterson was caught in unfamiliar territory, something like that?
Ross would always take a little dig at Pat Patterson in those situations.
Really, huh?
Yeah. Then Vince asks how many people have ordered this show to see the WWF title change hands, and they boo. Then he asks how many have tuned in to see Kane lit on fire if he loses, and they all cheer, these savages. And that you're setting yourself up for one big disappointment. And he cuts a heel promo on fans and their lives, being that they're all big disappointments. Just a giant time fill here by Vince McMahon cutting a heel promo on Pittsburgh. Totally.
I thought it went really long, but I enjoyed it.
It was the top heel in the company in Vince McMahon, so I'm not going to necessarily complain here. That leads us to the first of two semifinal bouts of the King of the Ring tournament. We have Jeff Jarrett against Scott Putski nominee Ken Shamrock in one semifinal bout. Jarrett is managed at the time by Robert Fuller, a.k.a. Tennessee Lee, who you can see on the forthcoming Ultimate Classic Wrestling Season 2 premiere. with Robert Fuller versus Ricky Steamboat.
What time would I catch that?
To be announced. Still waiting. Who's going to be cutting that show? And it'll probably be you, actually. That's that.
Really?
That.
Okay.
We'll see.
Well, I'll let you know.
Yeah. Ross brings up Bob Shamrock raising Ken when he ran away from home. Tennessee Lee distracts Shamrock and gets his knee clipped by Jarrett, and then works on the left ankle of Shamrock, and they play up the TV angle where Owen Hart injured Shamrock's ankle leading into this. Really annoying fan during this match I found who was blowing a whistle throughout this whole match, and clearly someone smacked him in the face because it ended after this match.
Hey, have you noticed on YouTube now there's a button for a vuvuzela? There's a vuvuzela
button. Are you kidding
me? Yeah. You don't get it all the time, but like in some of the World Cup videos, there's a little button with a soccer ball. You press it, and it just goes.
I hate those things.
Yeah, it's funny.
I can't stand the World Cup tournament, by the way.
Why not?
It's just...
I'm watching it right now. You're in the pool. Why did you join the pool?
I joined the pool just so I could be...
What?
Not get chastised for being the only person not in the pool, but I cannot wait for this tournament to be over.
Guess who's leading the pool?
Who? You are?
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah.
Who did you pick to win?
I picked Argentina.
And they're still in it, I assume.
They're just doing very well.
I think I picked France to go to the finals, so they're doing well. Ivory Coast, I think I picked for third place. Are they still in it?
I don't... we'll see. That's to be determined, but the chances are they won't.
What I hate are these people who every 4 years, all of a sudden, never hear a peep out of them, and then all of a sudden... Oh, I'm Italian, or I'm German, because my fourth-generation grandfather was from Germany. All of a sudden, the German blood is flowing through me.
You didn't have an English flag sticking out of your car?
No, I have relatives from Scotland and England, but I would not classify myself as either. I am Canadian. I was born in Canada. I do not have a representative in the World Cup, so why is it on me that I have to be a soccer fan? I have no nationalistic tie to this World Cup. I have no interest in honking my horn while I don't have a job to go to.
That's just you. That's just you.
I just can't wait for this tournament to be over. Can't people just watch soccer and just enjoy it without having to disrupt me? They're loud.
Why do you have to hate?
I don't hate, Wei, but let's find out where everybody is come the Euro Cup or the whatever.
Nobody
it is
cares
they
about
do.
That. No.
Yeah, exactly. It's like the Olympics. 4 years. People care. It's a vacuum sport. Back to professional
wrestling. Back to a real sport.
Real sport. Where were we? Ken Shamrock and Jeff Jarrett. Yes, I noted that Shamrock, his ankle was being worked on. And, of course, Shamrock hadn't exactly learned the concept of selling because he was right up and walking on his thing without a lift.
Yeah.
Great, great job, Ken. Then Shamrock hooks on the ankle lock, gets the win in about 5 minutes, and then he decides to limp after the match when someone probably... cued him in his ear.
It's adrenaline.
Yeah, that's it. Then Michael Cole does a post-match interview with Ken, who showed all of the charisma he probably did after his post-fight interview at UFC 1.
No.
Zero personality.
They didn't do this all the time, did they? Where they would interview guys only after the tournaments. They're trying to do like a UFC type of thing.
Yeah. Which, if they were trying to capture that UFC audience, you would think they would have chosen someone else to go over in this next match. It's The Rock against Dan Severn, with the winner taking on Ken Shamrock in the finals. The Nation, Mark Henry and The Godfather, come down with The Rock, and they are banned from ringside. And then they show Severn injuring D'Lo's pec muscles on Raw from 3 weeks ago, and that, of course, led to the great chest protector gimmick that D'Lo Brown incorporated.
Mm-hmm.
Ross mentions that Severn was a UFC Superfight champion, something you would never hear on a WWF broadcast in 2010. Severn is using his wrestling holds, such as a fireman's carry and joint holds onto The Rock early on. Rock casually takes his elbow pad off as he and just throws it down to the floor. This was before the elbow removal became a giant part of his match.
Mm-hmm.
Godfather and Henry return to distract the referee, and this leads to D'Lo Brown coming out of the crowd with the chest protector and hits the frog splash on Severn, and Rock gets the victory. So the tease of Shamrock versus Severn in the finals does not come through. And then
instead, we get to see a match that we've already seen.
Yes, this match took place at the Royal Rumble. It took place at WrestleMania. And who knows how many times on Raw leading into this pay-per-view. So we get a video. Michael Cole speaks to The Rock, who says that Shamrock may want to climb a mountain, but instead he will hit rock bottom. And then they show D'Lo Brown retreating through the audience, but he crotches himself on the metal barricade as he's leaving, and they decided to replay this.
We
go to a video then of Al Snow arriving in the WWF with Head, and for whatever reason, they chose this like cheesy game show music to put underneath this video, and it came across completely hokey. And then Lawler and Ross interview Al Snow prior to this match, and this was all designed for Lawler to get as many Head puns into this interview. And Snow responds saying that Head doesn't lay down for anybody, and they're going to get Head like they've never gotten Head before. Ha ha ha. The Attitude Era.
Yeah.
So clever. And that leads to Brian Christopher and Scott Taylor versus Al Snow and Head in one of the worst pay-per-view matches I've ever seen in my life. They announce Jerry Lawler as the guest referee for this match, and then Jim Ross promotes that The Rock and Ken Shamrock are currently on the WWF Superstar line, getting ready for their finals matchup. Lawler plays heel ref, stops an overhand right by Al Snow early on. Then we see a top rope sunset flip by Snow onto Christopher, but Lawler has a ridiculously slow count and will not count three for Al Snow. Snow then back body drops Taylor onto Christopher from the ring to the floor, and Taylor catches Christopher right in the face with his boot. I don't know how he wasn't busted open here. Taylor then goes for a springboard clothesline to the back of Al Snow on the floor and nearly dies in trying to pull this off. And might I say, the crowd complete flatline during this match.
Yeah, I was.
Snow then uses Head on Too Much and a snowplow to Taylor, but Lawler doesn't count. And then, in a spot that screamed Vince Russo, Lawler tosses a bottle of shampoo, of Head and Shoulders shampoo, to Brian Christopher, who attaches the bottle, and fails at doing so, to Head. He then pins the mannequin Head and gets the win, and then Christopher explains to the camera that they beat the Head and the Shoulders.
The Head has shoulders. That's how they were able to score the pin. I thought it was so funny.
No.
It was hilarious.
This was horrible.
It was so creative.
This was the worst finish ever. This was so bad that Jim Ross just hated this match and would not censor himself.
That is a first, ladies and gentlemen. It can likely be our last one for that little piece of business. Whoops, that's wasn't exactly what you'd call a stem wander down there in Muskogee, but...
We beat the Head, and we beat the Head! It has shoulders! We beat the Head!
Wow.
Come on, Head and Shoulders.
Ross then says, okay, well, we're going to get serious now. And that leads to our next match. It's Owen Hart taking on X-Pac. X-Pac is accompanied by China to the ring. And
his co-star.
Yes. In the lead-up to this, we see Owen crotch X-Pac in a King of the Ring qualifying match on Raw. And then a week later, X-Pac runs down to the ring and destroys Owen with a chair to the back of the head that required 7 staples. I cannot understate how unsafe this was by X-Pac and how completely amateur this chair spot came across by X-Pac. Mm-hmm. Just hitting a guy in the back of the head and opening him up. Holy fuck.
You hate that.
I hate... Why couldn't he have just hit him in the back? I guarantee that's how it was planned, was to be in the back, and he just fucking slipped and hit him in the back of the head.
They didn't know at the time. They didn't know that.
No, I don't. I think that was just him being careless. I don't think he was planning to hit him in the back of the head.
No, probably not. I ran into one of our listeners this past weekend, and in a real life situation, a listener, Brian Kwan, and he told me that he enjoyed the podcast, and he just laughs and loves it every time John mentions an unprotected chair shot. Because he knows John Pollock would always freak out.
Well, I'm sorry that I have an interest in these people not dying.
No, you don't have to be sorry. It's highly entertaining.
Well, I'm glad it's entertaining for everybody out there. You just wait till this Hell in a Cell match, everybody. Because I'm going to go off on this supposed classic. Anyway, let's get into this. Owen Hart and X-Pac, who met at the King of the Ring 1994 way. And now meeting 4 years later. We are already into the next match, but Ross cannot help but go back and talk about the previous match.
Well, I don't necessarily want to see ever again in my life another match like we just saw, quite frankly. I don't either. And now, thanks to me, you won't ever have to witness another abomination with Al Snow and that Snow hat. What a move! Beautiful! That last match was uglier than a bowling shoe, I'll tell you. What?
And he states that he never wants to see a match like that again, and then throws in the bowling shoe reference.
Mm-hmm.
On the floor, X-Pac is thrown into the timekeeper's table. Both are working well, but the crowd is still down from the last match. X-Pac goes to the top rope, and Ross notes, X-Pac's life has been a high risk.
Oh, yeah, isn't that true?
Hart goes for a superplex off the top, but I don't know what happened here, but his face got smashed into X-Pac's face, and then he took a back body drop, or a back bump off the top rope, and his eye is bloody. Like, the side of his left eye is all busted open. Like, just, man, was this sloppy. Then Mark Henry runs down and splashes X-Pac on the floor. China confronts Henry, and the crowd goes apeshit for China and Mark Henry teasing physicality.
Sure.
Wow.
Why wouldn't they?
I don't understand.
China was very special at the time. I mean, everybody was always curious about this manly woman. And what she could do against an actual man.
Then, in a spot that I had no idea was coming and had to rewind this 8 times, Vader runs down and delivers a belly-first splash into Henry and hits him so hard that he falls over from impact.
Mm-hmm.
This was awesome because it was so unexpected. I had no idea Vader was coming down here. This was great. This was right up with when Vader came back in 2005 on that edition of Raw.
Yeah.
And he did the same thing where he came down and he fell. Oh, Vader is just, oh, comedy gold.
I didn't think it was that funny. Come on.
Any guy falling like that is fun.
I just thought it was funny how we had 2 Mark Henry run-ins.
Oh, yeah, he was in the previous match.
Yeah.
Well, he was busy. Not as busy as China was going to be over the next 3
yes.
matches, but nonetheless, X-Pac is back in the ring after the splash. Owen applies the sharpshooter, but China comes in and delivers a DDT to Owen Hart. X-Pac sells on his back forever, and then finally turns over to pin Owen, who seems seriously hurt here. Like, they just roughed this guy up in this match, and X-Pac gets the win here. So rather than replaying the finish, Kevin Dunn, with his sense of humor, decided to replay Vader falling over. Thumbs up to Kevin Dunn for this match.
I didn't find it funny.
Oh, I laughed.
That happens in real life all the time. A guy kicks and then loses his balance.
But no. He ran down and went, like, his belly went into Mark Henry and then he fell over.
Because of
when
the
do
force.
You ever see that on
because
the street?
Of the, because of the force of his charge, of his attack. He just
this
ricocheted.
This guy played football. Why wouldn't he run and, like, tackle him or something?
That's not the move.
So he can maintain his...
Yeah, but that's
hitting
not...
a guy with your belly is going to knock the wind out of yourself more than it's going to do any damage to your fucking world's strongest man.
That's his move, though. That's his move.
Stupid move.
He can't change the move. Somebody already does the tackle.
All right. We are defending the logic of a man that wore a jockstrap for his career. Then we go to our next segment, Way, and Paul Bearer comes down, who Ross calls a pagan. They replay the angle from Raw where The Undertaker broke into Paul Bearer's home, even though the WWF maintained they never did vandalism, and The Undertaker proceeded to beat up Paul Bearer and vandalize his home. They mention how Paul Bearer mentions how Kane would watch WWF Superstars on Saturday morning when he was young and wasn't able to join the Boy Scouts or go out in the sun. So, Wei, I'm curious, if you were a kid, what would be the most important, going out in the sun, being in Boy Scouts, or watching WWF Superstars?
I'd watch the wrestling.
Yeah. Superstars would have been number one.
So we're as tortured as
I
Kane?
I was part of Boy Scouts, and I hated going every week. And then finally, when I was 12, I said, enough of this. I don't want to be part of it anymore. And my dad was like, well, if you want to quit Boy Scouts, then you have to call the head lady and quit yourself. So I called, and I said that school is getting really demanding and that work is piling up for this grade 6 kid and that I can no longer come.
That was my...
She was like, okay. I never came. I left it open. I'm like, if things get quieter over the next few years, I'll come back. And that was the end of me and Boy Scouts.
How insincere. I joined the Boy Scouts too, and we didn't do anything. For us, it was just an excuse to rent out the gym and play floor hockey.
See, that would be fine with me. like four times a year. I'd have to go on these bloody camping trips and tie knots.
They're fun. Those are fun.
I didn't enjoy it. I never enjoyed it.
Yeah, it was weird.
Yeah. I was also like, the group I was in, they were a bunch of fucking like pyromaniacs and shit. They'd go on these trips and they'd like almost kill each other. One guy, fuck, I'm going to get into this story right now. They found tear gas in the forest.
Wow.
It was like, I don't know if it was, it wasn't tear gas probably, but it was like these mushrooms that you could squeeze and shit would fly out of them. Ugh. So this kid runs in one day, because I didn't want to associate with any of these guys. They were fucking crazy. Guy comes in with shit all over his face, and I just seen Jurassic Park where Newman was killed with that velociraptor, yeah. Like, right. Spraying shit. So I thought this kid's going to be paralyzed. I went outside, and these fucking kids, after they almost murdered this kid, they're knocking trees over, like giant fucking trees in the forest. They're chopping and knocking over to try and hit each other with trees.
Fuck.
Hated Boy Scouts.
That's weird.
How many knots do you utilize other than for your shoes?
None. That's true. Two at the most. I didn't learn anything. It just seems like something that sounds like a good idea to parents.
Get rid of your kids for a night of the week. Of course it sounds appealing.
Let them watch wrestling.
Yeah. They'll turn out like us. That brings us to our next match, Way. The New Age Outlaws with China, who, since the last match, quickly ran back, put on a hat and purple sunglasses, and came out with the New Age Outlaws, taking on the new Midnight Express, who I'd completely expunged from my memory.
I had no idea what this was.
I forgot about this team.
And then once I saw two people walk out with Jim Cornette. And then once I realized who the two people were, I was just like, what the fuck?
What Bob Holly and Bart Gunn.
No.
No.
Bombastic Bob and Bodacious Bart. Not only that, they were the NWA Tag Team Champions. What the fuck?
However, you're probably thinking, oh, title versus title, but no, Jim Ross stated, even though the Midnight Express are the NWA Tag Team Champions, only the big one will be on the line.
Yeah.
Can you imagine Vince Russo, as part of creative, going to Jim Cornette, one of the legendary managers, and saying, we're going to recreate the Midnight Express with Bodacious Bob and Bombastic Bart? I'm sure Cornette just loved Russo at this point in time.
Mm.
Are the death threats warranted by Cornette?
Fuck, this is hilarious. And how did they convince the NWA to use their titles?
Because the NWA was nothing in 1998, and their name was being put on a WWE pay-per-view. I don't think they were exactly twisting their arm. Horrible music for the new Midnight Express, who had one of the most famous themes ever.
Giorgio Moroder.
That's it. Same guy who did the theme for Scarface.
Yes.
Billy and Bart have clearly gone distinctive paths, I notice, who they still played up as brothers in this match.
No heat. Yeah, you'd figure the first time, one of the first times, or one of the, I don't even know. I don't know. But, these guys have not met each other for a long time, and this is brother versus brother. You'd figure they'd play this up. But absolutely nobody in the audience got the connection.
No one cared.
Nobody cared. No heat for this pairing whatsoever.
Waller tries to explain the appeal of the New Age Outlaws, and he says, they're cool, like Beavis and Butthead and South Park, and the kids love them because they go out and they say what they feel. Lawler did so much damage to any coolness this duo had. Botched sunset flip spot by Billy as Bart lands on top of Billy. Crickets during this match. Billy gets on top of his brother, stands above, and yells, suck it, suck it, suck it! Which came across very creepy for two supposed storyline brothers to be yelling at one another. Lawler doesn't even know which member is which of the Midnight Express.
They argue who's bodacious and who's bombastic.
Yes. The New Age Outlaws, they state, learned of their opponents late in the morning because of their open contract. Can you imagine if UFC fighters had open contracts? And there was a bonus match added the morning of the UFC pay-per-view?
I can't imagine.
So, to follow up Billy Gunn's screaming of suck it, Bob Holly then floors Road Dogg and goes one further by saying something very unbombastic by stating, "Suck it! Fuck you!" to Road Dogg. Then we get a belt shot to Billy Gunn for a near fall. Cornette goes for a second belt shot after Gunn attempts an O'Connor roll, which is the only time I will use Pat O'Connor in reference to Billy Gunn. He uses the O'Connor roll on Holly, but China low blows Cornette, and the New Age Outlaws guillotine Holly on the top rope and Gunn pins Holly. So two matches in a row where China leads to the finish.
Mm-hmm.
Great agent work in this match. So the New Age Outlaws retain the tag titles. The big one stays with the New Age Outlaws. Mm-hmm. Fascinating match, isn't it, Way?
I loved it.
Then we cut to Triple H coming out with China, who comes out for the third straight entrance. Holy shit. Does she need to come out with him? Hunter comes into the ring and tears his shirt off, which Way does on occasion when he arrives at work. Total douchebag is Hunter at this time period.
Yeah.
I have a feeling, Way, if DX had come along in 2010, I would hate this group, which tells people that I'm getting old. Because I know people will, DX was great. And first of all, whenever people say, oh, it was so much better back here, there's always romanticizing about the past.
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot of shit that went on in the WWF in 98.
Yeah.
Inevitably.
Yeah.
And I just, it gets on me at times when people, they automatically, because it happened 10 years ago, it was great.
Mm-hmm.
Wasn't always great.
No.
I know 10 years from now, people are going to say, oh, man, those Cena Batista matches, those were classic. They don't do it anymore. WWE's so lame. Remember when they had the guest hosts? They were so mainstream. Guarantee you, John Cena one day will be revealed as...
It happens. It happens with everything. It happens with music. It happens with cartoons. You know? Sports. Whatever. People always like to think that their time was the best.
Just trying to look objectively here, everyone. I don't think I would be a fan of DX today.
No.
But it worked at the time.
So yeah, I mean,
my point is invalid.
You have to think that, you have to think about the...
Their audience at the time, that is what they wanted.
Yeah.
And they did... Who are we going to criticize? And I'm just saying, from my taste,
yeah.
And it would have got on my nerves.
And it was so different from what the WWE was just years before. This very clean-cut product without anything like that.
Yes. In 1998, this stuff was new. In 2010 in TNA, it is not. And that leads us way to the finals of the King of the Ring, The Rock versus Ken Shamrock, with Triple H on commentary and China doing the Spanish language commentary with Hugo Savinovich and the guy who does it with him.
I don't know his name either.
Carlos Cabrera.
Oh, excellent.
Hunter, while doing commentary, refers to The Rock as, wait for it, The Croc. He's fake. All comedy from Hunter. As Ken walks to the ring, looking serious for this tournament win, he says maybe Ken is thinking about that ham sandwich he had at lunch. Triple H says this is the WWF featuring athletes and not old men running around. As a shot at WCW. Rock takes a kick to the stomach. And this was hilarious because he backed off of Ken Shamrock and went to go through the ropes, but instead took a bump right down to the floor. Lost his step.
That's not funny.
Yeah, it was. Hunter is asked if he's bilingual, and he says he's a lot of bi things, but lingual isn't one of them. And then quickly takes that back, realizing what he has said on pay-per-view.
Mm-hmm. Classic line.
Yeah. Rock gets in Hunter's face, and then Hunter spits water in his face. Hunter checks his mic to see if it's working, but instead of saying testing, he says testes, 1, 2, 3.
I know a guy who did that in TV every time we would check a microphone.
Who's that?
Jake Thompson.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Testes, 1, 2, 3.
Maybe he was
three.
A Hunter fan.
I doubt it.
And the match builds to Shamrock making his comeback. They gave this King of the Ring Finals all of like 6 minutes. And the crowd gets really hot for the Shamrock near falls on The Rock. Hunter says that no one is sitting here. Everyone is on the edge of their seats. And then they do a wide shot of the crowd. And Hunter says, okay, well, some people are sitting. Shamrock holds the ankle lock. And Rock taps as Hunter yells, he's screaming like a broad. And then they go to a sign. They go to two signs. One I found hilarious and one not. The one non-funny sign was Shamrock, the real rock. And then they showed some fan at ringside who just randomly had this sign that said, "Go to hell, Carlos. Loser. Welfare." Written on either side of the sign.
I don't get it.
I don't know. He was just upset at his non-friend Carlos. It's just like, I hate this man, so I'm going to embarrass him.
The loser will have to go on welfare. Is that what he's saying?
No, no, no. He just wrote on a sign. It was like, on a sign like this, it said, "Go to hell, Carlos," and it said, "Loser, welfare." I guess he was trying to embarrass his enemy on pay-per-view. I don't know who Carlos is. I thought it was funny. It's like, maybe Carlos is watching this, and his buddy is calling him a welfare addict.
Would you do that to somebody you disliked? Just you know, go out in public with a sign like that?
Maybe. Depends on the person. And then Hunter, in his last ditch to get this final over and really put the shine on Ken Shamrock, ends off by saying that Shamrock can't beat him.
Okay. So
that's nice.
Yeah, whatever.
And that leads us way to the Hell in a Cell match between Mankind and The Undertaker. And Foley comes out first, climbs to the top of the cage to start, and then Undertaker, who coming into this match had a broken foot, climbs up the side of the cage with a broken foot. Foley uses a chair early on. They're walking on top of the cageway, and the fencing gives in, which to me right there was a sign that we are not going to do anything on top of this cage. This is not a secure ceiling.
No.
Very poorly built.
They've done it. This is, by the way, not the second Hell in a Cell match.
This was the third,
actually. The third Hell in a Cell match, because they did one on Raw with Kane and Austin. But in all of the matches, they would climb up to the top. So essentially, the cell was built for that reason.
Well, if you look at the Undertaker Shawn Michaels match, that thing was sturdy as hell. There was no way you were going through the top of that. Like, there was no bounce on the cell on top. This one, they just walked and went through it. So, bad sign right there off the bat. Taker tosses Foley off of the top of the cage in probably one of the greatest calls in the history of Jim Ross's career.
Undertaker fighting back. He's fighting back. They're running above us, folks. And now they're locking a damn bit. Oh, my God. I cannot believe
this is over right here.
I cannot believe it's over. That cage is 16 feet high.
So the crowd becomes unglued at this spot. Just absolutely apeshit here. And you can tell Ross is legitimately concerned here for Foley, as I don't believe he had any clue that this spot was coming.
It really was, though, as perfect a landing as you could have
made. It was
made.
Shot perfectly. He landed probably as best you could. In that, there was no margin for error on this spot. Had he missed and hit that guardrail, dead.
Oh, yeah.
No had doubt. He hit his head, dead.
No.
It was unbelievable that, like, if I was the Undertaker, I would be like, "God bless you, Mick, for wanting to do this." No fucking way.
Yeah.
No way.
Yeah.
Because I could not visualize this not ending in tragedy. Like, it's unbelievable. And the positive of this is that the WWF has made this probably the most famous spot in their history. It's not like this has just been some forgotten, like, canyon going off the top of that triple cage and you've never remembered it since until I mentioned it right now. I mean, anyway, that's only the first spot of the match.
I always forget how early that came in.
That was 2 minutes into the match. Yeah. And this led to, I'm sure, legitimate concern that this match was over. Terry Funk and the officials come out to check on Mick Foley. They do show a replay of this multiple times, including Hugo Savinovich falling over in his chair in slow motion, which if you have not seen, go back and watch Hugo Savinovich. He almost stole the scene here. As amazing as that sounds.
You love guys falling.
Very safe fall off of his seat, but it was done so funny that I implore you to go watch this. Taker is just stuck on top of the cage, not knowing what's going on. Vince McMahon comes out, not in character. They raise the cell with Taker on top of the cage to make room for Foley to get out on a stretcher as chants of Undertaker go throughout the arena. Mm-hmm. Foley is taken out on a stretcher, but then gets up off of the stretcher near the entrance and walks back to a gigantic pop. I would be very concerned if I was the WWF and the liability here of allowing this man to go back and continue this match. Mm-hmm. Like, gross negligence on the part of the WWF. If Foley were to ever file a lawsuit that came out of this match, granted he was doing this on his own, but he was not in the right frame of mind here, I think, to be making any sound decisions about what his body could do.
Yeah, I suppose so.
I'm just saying, if you're a lawyer watching this, and Foley was seriously injured, there's a hell of a case against the WWF for willfully allowing him to continue this match.
Yeah, but I don't know. I never really think about that. What I do think about is just, I remember one of the first episodes of Sunday Night Heat, they would replay old classic matches and have the participants talk about them. And perhaps the first one they did was this Hell in a Cell. And then Foley just kind of went through the whole match, talking about what he was thinking about. And his feeling while he was going up the stretcher after that big fall was that he hadn't given the audience enough yet. He felt that this was a major pay-per-view match, and the match had only lasted 2 minutes, even though he did, you know, take one of the craziest bumps in history. He felt that he didn't give the audience enough yet, and that's why he came back for the second fall. It was crazy.
Foley comes back, climbs the cage, which Undertaker had come down at this point and had to climb again. Then, of course, this led to the second famous spot in this match, where Foley took a choke slam on top of the cell, descended all the way down to the apron, which at this point, these were the old WWF mats from the 80s, where they were just rock solid at the time. They've since softened them. But what you don't notice in this is that there was a chair on top of this cage, which came down and smashed Foley in the face upon impact with the apron. Just an ungodly spot that the pain this man must have been in here. It's just incredible.
The chair falls onto his mouth and knocks out a tooth, which somehow finds its way through his mouth and out of his nose.
Insane.
Yeah. And, of course, at this point, Foley is unconscious.
Yeah, he is out here.
Yeah.
The officials come back in, including Terry Funk. Undertaker has to hang down from the cage and land on his broken foot here onto the apron. Like, this guy was in a lot of pain in this match. And they were just trying to kill time. Terry Funk took a choke slam. They show the close-up of Foley with the bloody mouth and the tooth hanging from his nose. And then they continue the match, as amazing as that sounds, with the Undertaker's forehead, which gets bloodied up. Foley then brings thumbtacks in, and they tease back and forth spots of each taking the tack spot. Foley applies the mandible claw, and then Taker lifts Foley up into a piggyback position and drops him almost away from the tacks. He catches a couple, and then Foley rolls over top the other tacks. Foley gets up, takes a choke slam onto the tacks, and then finally, Taker hits the tombstone for the win in this maybe the most violent WWF match in history, which, without question, is still remembered. But watching this here, I don't ever want to see a match like this again.
No.
I don't ever want to see a performer endure this much punishment. Yeah. I don't care how much people remember this match as being great. I know I'm always cynical on this shit. It's fine. But this match was probably took years off this guy, the end of this guy's life.
Perhaps. But it also made him, you know? I mean, you can be somebody starting out and look at this match and say, this is very dangerous, but, I mean, look what it did for his career.
But I think people that got into wrestling thinking, hey, I can just fall off shit mm-hmm. to make it, mm-hmm. came in with the wrong idea.
Yeah.
Because Mick Foley was a lot more of a performer. Oh, yeah. He had a lot more of a dynamic than just being a guy who could take big bumps. He was an incredible promo guy, incredible mind for the industry in terms of putting together his storylines. I mean,
and he's a good wrestler.
A very good wrestler. And had a lot more going for him than just the hardcore guy.
Yeah, that's true. Now that I think about it, I mean, it wasn't just this match that really propelled Foley up to the top. It was his comedic character, the comedic side of that Mankind character that really ultimately put him over the top. Do you know if those spots were planned? The tosses off of the through the cage, the tosses, yeah, that one. Do you know if that one was planned beforehand?
I think I've heard him talk about it before that the choke slam spot, they were never expecting the cage to break. It was supposed to just be a choke slam on top, and I don't know what the plan was to get back into the cage. It could have been all on the fly. It could have been that the throwing off the top was to get them down onto the ring level. But
it's so crazy. Because, like, I mean, if I was Undertaker...
Like that top wasn't gimmicked to break.
Yeah. But, I mean, if I was Taker, I would have, you know, it would take a lot for me to sense that this guy was okay before I would even continue the match.
I would not have felt comfortable at all. The guy had to, if you figure at the least, have a concussion at this point.
Yeah.
But, yeah, it's...
Foley doesn't, by the way, didn't remember anything about the match until he watched it again afterwards. So he was wrestling a lot of this on instinct, it seemed.
Not to mention his family was watching this on pay-per-view.
Oh, yeah.
Can you imagine what's going through your mind watching 10 minutes of this, that must have felt like?
Yeah.
I mean, it's a defining match in the Attitude Era, and you're right. It put Mick Foley at a completely, it put him at that top level after this match. I hate to see someone take this much. That's why I go crazy over some of, look at Abyss and what he does.
Yeah.
Month after month, he tries this stuff.
He does it for nothing.
It has no impact.
Yeah, no,
it's done
no
nothing
difference.
For Abyss's career.
It's true. This match wasn't much of a match.
It was a spectacle.
No, it was a setting for a guy to jump off of things. I mean, that sounds harsh for something that's considered legendary, but that's what it was. It wasn't a wrestling match.
No.
It was just a setting for stunts.
For those as well, Mick Foley will be the first one to say that he does not want people to think of his career that is defined by this match. He would much rather people look at his match with...
Michaels,
yeah. The Randy Orton match they had in Edmonton.
Sting.
Yeah, he definitely doesn't want to be defined by this. At the same time, he has to understand why people always are going to associate him with this Hell in a Cell. I interviewed him once, actually, and I mentioned the Hell in a Cell. He got really annoyed at me for bringing it up. And it was like, you know, that's a giant part of your career, whether you like it or not. And it's you accomplished what you set going into that match.
Yeah.
Like, whatever goals you had in mind, you more than exceeded them coming out of that match and the legend that this match has become. So, amazingly, two more guys had to follow this match.
Yeah.
And...
No way were they ever going to... I was just concerned about the crowd. But amazingly, the crowd was pretty into the next match,
too. You also had the hottest guy in the industry, so that helped. Steve Austin and Kane for the WWF title in their first blood match, where if Kane lost, he would light himself on fire. They show that Undertaker and Kane, they had a number one contenders match on Raw, which Kane won through the distraction of Mick Foley to the Undertaker. And then the build-up features Kane and Foley putting Austin into a casket. And then on Raw, Austin and Kane fighting on top of the Hell in a Cell cage leading into this, as well as Kane dumping blood from the ceiling onto Austin. All of this done to this classical music. I thought this video... was awesome.
That was good.
Very good video.
Not near the level that they're at right now, but you know.
No, but at this time, like, I was psyched for this main event after watching this, which is a chore for Kane. Mm-hmm. Austin just gets a massive pop coming out, and I didn't know this going in, but he had like his right elbow was just taped up, huge. And Ross explains that he was in the hospital for 3 days in the week leading up to this with staph infection and had a fever. So you had Austin and Undertaker both really hurting going into this.
Yeah.
Austin early on is...
See, hold on a second. Like, I mean, if a guy wrestles with with staph infection, isn't that a hazardous to the other competitor or to any of the other wrestlers?
Of course it is. They took a risk in this match by taping it up so much so that there would be no interaction with Kane's skin.
That's disgusting.
It's definitely.
And on the first blood match.
Yeah.
Where he's bleeding all over the place.
Yeah. Yeah, there's definitely an argument to be made there for how important it was to... but, I mean, this was a very different time period, something you would not have seen in today's WWE.
I'm just thinking about the whole Mark Hamill situation from this past weekend with when he fought with a staph infection against Keith
Jardine. Well, the deal with Matt Hamill was that they were stating that his staph was not contagious, which I don't know how legitimate that is. Staph is... You're not fucking around when it comes to staph infection. And being in a sweaty environment, colliding with another guy's skin on skin, if I was a commission, I would not have allowed that fight to have taken place.
Yeah, and I just heard a huge uproar over that. And thinking about this match, nobody will think twice. You know, first of all, very few people will even know about Austin and his situation. But, yeah, in wrestling, it just seems like there's a whole different level of precautions.
Standards. Yep. Yeah. Austin, early on, delivering belt shots. All of his offense was built around trying to open up Kane, which I thought was good. Now, Kane was also wearing a mask.
So. Kane was not only wearing a mask, he was wearing a full bodysuit. Not
smart!
Even... Yeah, but... how would he lose? How would he lose?
Well, I think if you did a good job of presenting that, that's a compelling issue going into this match, was how can Austin win this match? I think you have to design that. If it was Austin and Kane, singles match, thrown out on pay-per-view, do you think people would be that interested? I don't know if they would be. But in this situation, I think it was at a time when I think people, first of all, suspended a lot more disbelief in wrestling. But you also presented a scenario where either we're going to see a title change, something that meant something in 1998, or we're going to see a guy get lit on fire. And you presented the scenario where it was almost impossible that Austin would retain, that I think that curiosity would get people's interest.
I suppose so.
I didn't have a problem with it at all.
I suppose so, but as for the match itself, I don't think Kane came close to bleeding even once. There's no suspense there.
Could have thought maybe get unmasked. Maybe.
I don't know.
That being said... what I hated during this match was the fucking cell. It came down, it went up, it came down, it went up.
The first time it came down, Kane tried to use it to guillotine Austin.
Jesus Christ. I didn't understand what this...
A giant cell.
Fuck. They explained that Earl Hebner won't stop the match for something minor, and then Austin gets scraped on the back and begins bleeding. But they said they're not going to stop it for a bleeding nose or any sissy blood.
Or a staph infection.
Yeah, none of that stuff. Yeah. They show Vince McMahon in his private box with Sable. Then on the floor, Austin grabs a fan from the announce table and throws it at Kane's face, like just full force at his face. That would have hurt. Then Austin is thrown into Hebner on the floor, knocks out Hebner, who collides with the barricade. Then Foley, after the match we just saw, is sent out for the main event. I could not believe this.
I mean, I'm sure that he was part of a...
I'm sure he was booked for this finish. And
yeah, but I'm sure, like, it was his own will to come out to, you know? Like, he's just that type.
He's acknowledged he did not even remember the match. I don't think he was really coherent when
That's
he probably...
True.
That being said, he was a big part of the finish, so he almost had to be part of it, but it goes, again, to wrestling standards and how ridiculous this is, that this angle maybe couldn't have been shot the next night, or if they could have... worked around the finish.
The other thing is, I mean, the booking of that Hell in a Cell match, it got to the point where these bumps were so big, the audience wasn't even thinking about storylines anymore. They were thinking about the performers, and because of that, you had Mick Foley end up as a huge babyface, in my opinion, after taking those insane bumps, and actually Taker more as the heel for continuing to attack this guy. Despite,
but that was
going
fine because that was
stuff.
Somewhat the direction they were going.
Okay, but then why have Mankind come out in a heel role at right here?
Well, I don't think you had really performed the turn in that one match, but you could see.
But you're carrying that momentum. You want that.
Based
momentum.
On their plan was to get to Austin and Taker at SummerSlam, babyface heel, and at this point Taker was a face, Foley was a heel, and I think these two matches were a large part of changing that tide. I don't think it was going to be instant that Foley was a babyface.
Okay.
It wasn't a big problem to me, but I do see what you mean. Foley runs out. He takes a stunner, and that leads to a stunner on Kane. Then the Undertaker runs down with a chair, and he goes to wallop Foley in the face. But as he does, Foley ducks, and Austin is holding a chair. So Undertaker hits Austin's chair into his face, busts him open with the interesting storyline. Was Taker aiming for Foley, or was he aiming for Austin? And the Undertaker then grabs Earl Hebner, throws him in the ring, and pours gasoline all over Earl Hebner to revive him. And Earl Hebner immediately sees that Austin is bleeding. He rings for the bell, and that's your winner. Kane is the new WWF champion, and then Austin hits Kane with an unprotected chair shot.
Sick.
Now, Wei, I'm imagining you watched this online, because I had the VHS copy of this, and that meant bonus footage, which featured Austin in the ring stunned as fans chant bullshit. So here, for the live audience and for the WWF home video, Mick Foley comes into the ring. Austin gets his heat back by delivering another stunner to this poor man, Mick Foley, who has taken so much punishment on this evening. Then Gerald Briscoe takes a stunner as Austin's music plays, and Foley is helped to the back with Sergeant Slaughter. And that ends the King of the Ring 1998, a very painful night for one Mick Foley. And your ranking out of 10, Wei?
It really, for me, it was only obviously a one-match show, so I give it about a 6 out of 10.
I'll go 7 out of 10 for historical significance, and I somewhat enjoyed the main event. I thought it was one of Kane's better matches, and I thought Austin was, considering he was going in with staff, he performed very, very well in this main event. The last two matches did it for me. Hmm. I was happy with that. So I will give it whatever I just said, out of 10.
7.
7 out of 10. So there we go. Combined 6.5 out of 10.
Before 13 we get to your out of 20.
Yes. Before we get to your feedback, it's time for our interview this week. This was conducted in November of 2000 on The Law with former co-host Jeff Merrick chatting with Jim Ross about the infamous 1998 Hell in a Cell.
Let's talk about the stakes getting higher, Jim. One of the matches that you'll forever be linked with was the Hell in a Cell match with Undertaker and Mick Foley. What was going through your mind as you saw Mick jump off the cage, get choked in through the cage? I mean, you have a personal connection to Mick. What was going through your mind?
The Undertaker was working in Dallas and eating pork and beans, and just barely getting by, when I saw him on a tape from Dallas, and I was working for Turner, and we hired him through my recommendation in Atlanta. So I had a good, very strong relationship with the Undertaker as well, because from them from Atlanta and him being seen on TBS, Vince saw it, and the Undertaker ended up coming here. So I feel I have a good, certainly a good rapport with him. And Mick is, well documented on his book, but I've mentioned many times Mick I have a soft spot in my heart for Mick Foley. I couldn't believe it, and if I can go out at ringside and not know everything that's going on, it's better. It's better for me. It's better for the viewer, because I'm a whole lot more natural, a whole lot more spontaneous. I did not know that Mick falling off the cage was in the game plan.
What did you have on your game plan that day? What did you have on your format sheet?
Oh, I knew the match was going to happen, but I didn't have, okay, they're going to do this, they're going to go do that, then they're going to go do this. We don't write that down.
Okay.
I don't want to know it. I mean, I'd rather not know. I'd rather just, I love that, being a fan. I like going out there and not knowing and then calling the action and just being there spontaneous. So, I only knew Hell in a Cell, Undertaker versus Mankind, and there you are. That's it. And I knew what I was going to do coming into that segment, and I knew what I was doing going out of it, either going to whatever it was. But for the life of me, I never, ever, ever dreamed that Mick Foley would go off the cage. And of course, none of us knew that Mick would break through. The second time he fell through was certainly inadvertent.
Mm-hmm.
And both those situations just stopped my heart. So it was amazing to me. I'll never forget that deal. Mick is I hope that you know that's enough. You know, we don't need to raise the bar anymore on that thing. I think that was. I hope the last time we ever see that maneuver.
Yeah, that kind of leads into my next question, Jim. At any point, once you knew Mick was all right, were you angry at him for doing something like that and putting not only himself at risk, but his family as well?
Well, no, I wasn't angry, but I felt more relief than anything else that I knew that he was in one piece.
Mm-hmm.
It's hard to get angry at Mick for wanting to do something that the fans would perceive to be memorable and that they would never forget, even at the risk of hurting himself. And certainly, that maneuver was his idea. And he felt very confident that he could pull it off without any serious injury. And luckily, thank God he did, but it's hard to get mad at Mick Foley, Jeff. He's one of those guys that you have a hard time being angry with for very long anyway.
So that was Jim Ross commenting on the Hell in a Cell match from 1998 involving Mick Foley, one of the most famous matches that Ross's voice will be associated with. And from their way, we will now go into our feedback for this week before we wrap things up. And do you want to start off?
Yeah, I do. Jamie Weaver writes to us and says, "You guys are doing great reviews. I live down here in Atlanta and wake up listening to, ironically, Tony Schiavone doing sports on the local AM station. I started watching wrestling when I was 5 years old. I grew up on NWA, Mid-South, and then WCW. It was good back then, but it sucks now. I was going to request the 1987 Jim Crockett Sr. Memorial Cup Tournament with the likes of the Malkies, Lasertron, and Jimmy Valiant, Shaska Watley, and Tejo Khan. Hopefully you will be able to find it to review it. I just want to thank you guys for the great shows and keep it up."
Cool. I don't know what lengths we'll go to find that, but Kaylin Baker writes, "ROH put on a great show in Toronto. I got to meet the boys of Review Away and Jim Cornette, who was more than happy to talk shit about Eric Bischoff and Vince Russo with me. Pretty sweet night." This comment here led to, without question, the dumbest back-and-forth thread we have ever had on Review Away between Andrew McMahon and Daniel Power, where Andrew McMahon wrote, "Don't do drugs, dude, the 5 D's, or something to that effect. And these two have gone back and forth like 8,000 times arguing over this. And if you have some cells to spare, go check out this thread on Kaylin Baker's comment.
What did they talk about? Why?
I don't know. They argue over if there are 5 D's in his statement or 4. You go vote, everyone. Let's keep going.
All right. Mo Zubaydi. Is that right? Is that how I'm pronouncing it?
Zubaydi.
"Hey guys, thanks for reading a few of my messages on the podcast. Can't wait for the King of the Ring 1998. This pay-per-view was obviously significant for the Taker vs. Mankind Hell in a Cell match. If somebody can please post a link to watch the pay-per-view, I would appreciate it. I know it's difficult for people to pronounce my name." Oh, there it is. "So if I'm fortunate enough to have my messages read out, it's pronounced Zubaydi. Zubaydi. So you got it wrong, John. Keep up the great work."
Daniel Power writes, "I like ROH as much as anyone, but I didn't enjoy the review this week. I just want to hear you guys tear shit apart and be negative. So try and stick to poorly booked wrestling shows such as Vince Russo era WCW or TNA. If you guys make it to 1,000 members, you should celebrate by having another John vs. Wade drinking contest or have a contest for the members where the winner gets $1,000. Guaranteed that is not happening."
Yeah, that's a great idea. Let's ask the Fight Network for $1,000 that we can give.
We got to write off a contest.
Yeah. Steve Orlowski, "Great review this week. Even on a serious show, John got off a couple of great rants. I especially enjoyed the one on the production values. Being a person who works in TV, ROH reviews every once in a while are okay, especially after the shit that was the Bash 2000. Looking forward to the King of the Ring review."
Eric Kramer writes, "Hey guys, great review of the ROH show. I don't have a problem with you reviewing a great show every once in a while. It shows that you understand what makes a great show, and that lends you both infinite credibility when you tear apart an awful one. I like when you try to branch out in your choices of reviews, so I would like to suggest The Self-Destruction of the Ultimate Warrior. It would be interesting to see your approach to reviewing a retrospective on the career of one of the craziest people on the planet. The matches and Easter eggs included on the disc are great, with one of the many highlights being the old Warrior University ads that paints the Warrior like some kind of painted-up messiah."
We've reviewed a DVD in the past. We reviewed that Kurt Angle one.
Yes.
a long time ago. But the problem with those is, like, how do you
review them?
How do you review them?
Because like, it's almost like giving play-by-play on what they say.
Yeah. It's like the way we do these reviews is like John would just do a recap of everything that happens, but how would you do a 3-hour DVD? Yeah. I don't know.
We also tried to review the Kane DVD they released, and you and me tried to sit through the bio and some of the matches, didn't we?
No, I don't remember that.
It was a Kane DVD, not a movie. It was like the WWE released a Kane like 3-disc set.
Oh, shit. Yeah, and it was just
and
like...
And the documentary was done in character.
There was no documentary, was there?
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. No.
No, there wasn't.
Was it just him in character throwing to his matches?
Yeah, I think that was it.
Yeah. What were we thinking?
I don't know. But, I mean, I'd be up for doing a DVD provided it was, like, you know, a proper length. Like, that China one was okay.
Oh, yeah, the Triple H in China one. Yeah. It's our time.
Jack Bisco writes, "Hey guys, if you guys reach 1,000, you should hold a contest to see which member can guest spot on Reveal Away. What about that idea?"
It's not a bad idea. All of these ideas are interesting, except for the $1,000 giveaway. And we'll have lots of time to take your suggestions, because we are very far away from... We gained one member this week, everybody. In fact, after we made the big push for 1,000, we lost 2 people.
Yeah, we kept...
And then we gained 3. Yeah. So we made a net profit of 1 member in the past week. So we are very far away from 1,000.
This whole week, the number has just been hovering around 850. I would see it go up and then go down. So
please, everyone, just...
make up your minds.
Just get your wrestling friends to join and get them to listen.
Make a fake account and join.
Just hack into friends' accounts and just join them up.
Yes.
We don't care if they're legitimate 1,000, just 8,000. John, that cannot be his last name, "After 1,000 members, Review Away should be live in front of a studio audience." Done.
Yeah, that's
we'll
great
have them all here into the Review Away studios.
We'll fit them all in here, in our little booth. Jesus. That John's first.
What would a studio come to watch us do? Just sit and talk?
Yeah.
There's nothing interactive with a studio we could do.
Yeah, I know. Brian Hillhouse, "How about having Mouth and Agnew as guest reviewers to commemorate 1,000 members?
Good.
Yeah, we could do that.
Brian also adds, "One thing I remember from the event, that being the King of the Ring, other than the obvious Hell in a Cell match, was Triple H doing play-by-play during a tournament match and someone mentioning China being bilingual and asking if Triple H was too. His reply was, 'Yes, there's a lot of bi things I am, but lingual's not one of them.'" Yes, we did note that, and I think Hunter realized what he said on live pay-per-view and quickly backtracked before rumors persisted.
Yeah, what can I say? Ryan Gilbert, "How about once you get to 1,000, you do a retrospective episode of which was your best and or worst show or shows you guys ever reviewed?"
We would review away.
Yeah.
That's
actually
not fun.
We should, though, for like the first anniversary, we should review the first podcast.
Review the first podcast. Maybe we could do that. It's coming up in September, everybody. Yeah. Ground zero.
Oh, God.
Who's next here? Jay Hunter. Yeah. "Maybe for your 1,000th review, you pick the pay-per-view and we write the script for the show. You pick out the best lines and they get read out like you were saying them."
That would be fun. But not the best lines. We would just read your script word for word. Somebody would write John Pollock.
Angry.
Yeah.
Waiting. Optimistic.
Yeah. Like an actual script. And we'd try to act out your script. That would be a great idea. If somebody wants to write up a whole an hour review, including
if it gets us to 1,000, we'll do it.
Yeah. All right.
Ben Breezeball, way.
Ben Breezeball, yes. He says a few interesting things on his commentary.
I think he's referring to Hunter.
Okay. Hunter says a few interesting things on this commentary about the Rock Shamrock match. He also says something like, "WWF is where the real athletes go, not old men who roll around on the mat, and that it doesn't matter how much stroke you've got with the guy running the show, how far you can stick your nose up somebody's butt who's running the show. It's all about who's got it in that ring." Yeah, how ironic.
Let's go to Scott McCullough, who says, "Hey guys, not being that familiar with the ROH product, it was something new and apart from the norm. I definitely think that having Gabe and Joe on to discuss their roles/opinions on the show helped a great deal, at least from my point of view. Also, may I suggest a DVD or two of to review on the upcoming weeks? I know, being a longtime Review Away fan, some of your older DVDs were great. Anyone looking for a classic should find your Kane DVD review. Perhaps Rise and Fall of ECW or WCW would be great, not only for some of the matches, but seeing how the WWE slanted history for their own benefit. Thanks as always, guys.
Right, okay, so we did do it. Graham McPhail, 1,000 members, you review the original Hogan movie, No Holds Barred, and or one of the subsequent shows that Hogan faced Zeus on.
That'd be a great idea to review No Holds Barred.
Oh, that'd be amazing.
Amazing commentary idea. For it.
Yeah, we should. Maybe we should get a couple of our friends from another podcast.
Nah, that's way too much work.
Yeah, okay.
So that wraps up this week's edition of Review Away, and quickly before we end off here, Way, this past Wednesday, we felt a natural disaster here in Toronto. A earthquake that registered a 5.0 on the Richter scale hit us, and I was just wondering, did you feel the earthquake?
I was out downtown at a shoot, and I did not feel anything. The only thing that told me that there was an earthquake was one of the other producers there. He pointed out that he felt a bit of a shaking on the floor, and he told me to look at computer monitor that was on the desk, and the monitor was shaking. So that was about it. It was like just waving side to side, and I just thought that there was like a really strong fan attached to the building or something. But then we started checking Twitter.
Of course.
We realized there was an earthquake.
It was over capacity yesterday.
Twitter?
Well, what's new? Twitter's always over capacity.
Yeah.
It's built like ridiculous.
Yeah.
Okay, so that was the earthquake. I felt it. I was like, what's going on here?
Yeah.
People were panicking and stuff. And I didn't understand. It was like a subway was going underneath you. I didn't understand the need to be dramatic about it.
Yeah, in Toronto, it wasn't really that big. But I'm sure in Ottawa, maybe Scott McCullough couldn't let us know.
Yeah.
He probably felt it a lot more.
For those outside of Toronto, the headline on the Toronto Sun this morning was Quake, Rattle, and Roll.
Not funny.
Hilarious.
You actually took the opportunity to make fun of people's concerns over the earthquake.
Just having some fun.
John Pollock went on Facebook to this gentleman, Ian Brewster's account, and then he had mentioned that one of our colleagues, Candace, had died in the earthquake.
Wow. I meant it very sarcastically. And then I guess on my follow-up, when someone asked if she had died, I said, no confirmed injuries yet. And then all of a sudden, people believed that I was being serious, and I caused a bit of a concern for some that our colleague Candace DeVay had been injured in the earthquake, but she is safe. So everyone on Facebook can rest assured.
Yeah.
I thought I was sarcastic.
Let me just see this. I think Candace is still out cold, but it's okay. We have other on-air talent. And then this guy, Ronald Skinner, says, wow, that's fucked. Did they die? And then Ian says, no reported injuries yet. And then John says, stable condition right now. Cannot confirm injuries. And then Ian writes back, dude, I thought you were joking. Oh, my God. Sorry, man. Wishing her the best. Holy cow. What happened to her? And then Candace finally responds, he was just joking. I just took a little nap.
Ian might be listening to this. He is a listener of the law, so he might be catching this. So go check out Warrior One, Ian Brewster's promotion he works with in the mixed martial arts world.
And chastise him for not understanding internet sarcasm.
So that was our earthquake day, our special John Tenta day in Toronto. And as we finish off here, Way, next week it will be a long weekend for many as we celebrate Canada Day as well as Independence Day. And what would you like to review next week?
One of our faithful listeners, Jay Hunter, sent us about last week, sent us some links to some wrestling-themed episodes of comedies, and I'd like to review both of them.
Okay.
First one being It's Always Sunny in Philadelphia. They have an episode called The Gang Wrestles for the Troops. And then South Park did an episode on
I heard about this.
Parodying wrestling. Have you seen either of
no,
these?
No, I've seen neither.
Well, I would like to review both of them. They combined combined, they run for about 45 minutes, so I will get
each?
The links up there.
Oh, combined, gotcha.
Yeah, combined.
That's a good time.
Yeah, I'll get the links up there. I'm sure a lot of you guys have already seen these, so please post your feedback, your thoughts. We'll be recording the podcast most likely on Wednesday, so get your thoughts in before then, and we will read them out loud.
In the meantime, and in between time, be sure to go to reviewaway.com. That's reviewaway.com, or just simply search The Law Review Away on Facebook. Just get our numbers up. Post on the wall any of your thoughts of what we are reviewing, or just any other questions, and we will be sure to answer them on here. And next week, we will review two episodes, South Park and It's Always Sunny in Philadelphia, right here on Review Away. And as we go out, a special tribute to 1999 to the tune of Eiffel 65's smash hit, I'm Blue.
Oh, my God.
Yo, listen up, here's the story about a little guy that lives in a blue world. And all day and all night and everything he sees is just blue, like him. Inside and outside, blew his house with a blue little window and a blue Corvette. And everything is blue for him and himself and everybody around, 'cause he ain't got nobody to listen to. I'm blue, da-ba-dee-da-ba-dye, da-ba-dee-da-ba-dye, da-ba-dee-da-ba-dye.
Trees are too. I have a girlfriend and she is so blue.